It's Central Time. You're with us on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's National College Savings Month, but skyrocketing college costs can make it hard to get started. We get tips from the host of a personal finance podcast. First, the U.S. Department of Justice is asking a federal judge to block enforcement of Texas's recent abortion law. That law effectively bans the procedure after about 6 weeks into pregnancy, and there are no exceptions for rape or incest. The law is considered the most restrictive measure in the country. The U.S. Supreme Court recently allowed Texas to go ahead with it. The Biden administration then sued the state over the matter. The Supreme Court is also planning to review Mississippi's abortion law, which bans most procedures after 15 weeks. At issue are a couple of long-standing decisions that have allowed states to regulate, but not ban, abortions before fetal viability. Those would be Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Mississippi wants justices to overturn them. Now, here in Wisconsin, advocates on both sides of the abortion debate say this is the closest we've come to outlawing abortion since Roe v. Wade was handed down in 1973. So what happens here if the ruling is reversed? Well, the answer is a little bit complicated. Now, you can join us at 800-642-1234. What do you ultimately want to see happen with abortion in Wisconsin or across the country? Should it be permitted or banned? What situations would you support it? Or do you think that it's no one's business? Call in now, 800-642-1234. Again, that number is 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Jesse Opoyan is the State Capitol Bureau Chief with the Capitol Times. Jesse, nice to have you back on Central Time.
Great to be back, JC.
So let's look at Wisconsin's abortion law because it goes pretty far back. Can you talk a bit about it?
Sure. It goes very far back. The earliest we know is 1849. It could have been earlier, but we know that there's a law in 1849, which is, I'm sure everyone knows, a year after Wisconsin became a state. So pretty much as long as we've existed as a state, abortion has been illegal in Wisconsin. Under the ban, any person except for the mother who, under the law, quote, intentionally destroys the life of an unborn child, unquote, is guilty of a class H felony. So it does have a few exceptions if it's deemed medically necessary to save the mother's life, but it doesn't make exceptions for rape, incest, or the mother's health, mental or physical. That ban was amended in 1985 to make sure that those penalties only apply to physicians, like I said, not to the women who are having abortions. But because of Roe versus Wade, it's been unenforceable since that Supreme Court decision.
So we've had Roe versus Wade for close to five decades at this point, and it basically superseded state laws on the matter. So looking at Wisconsin's, which has not been enforceable even with that that amendment in the 80s, how does our law compare to 11 other states that also have an abortion ban?
Sure. Well, there are eight states, Wisconsin included, that have a ban that was put into law before Roe versus Wade was decided. And those are much older laws. Then there are 11 who enacted bans after Roe versus Wade. And those were, you know, with the knowledge that they couldn't be enforceable, but with the intention that they would take effect if the ruling would be overturned. And the net effect is pretty much the same across the board for all of those.
We're talking to Jesse Opoyan right now. She's the State Capitol Bureau Chief with the Capitol Times. We are talking right now about Texas's recent law regarding abortion and what it's being called one of the most restrictive, if not the most restrictive in the country, and the upcoming Supreme Court fight over it. And you can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. So people on both sides of this debate are either concerned or hopeful that Roe versus Wade could be overturned, given these laws that we've seen in other states. And if we want to maybe have a thought experiment here, let's say that Roe is cast down. What would then happen here in Wisconsin?
Well, we'd probably see some lawsuits starting pretty quickly. We'd probably be seeing some legislation being introduced too, just based on whichever interest is being represented. But there's not really, I mean, both sides agree on this. There's not really anything necessary to be done to trigger it into taking effect. Basically, if it's overturned by the Supreme Court, the ban takes effect here in Wisconsin. What that means in terms of enforcement is it's up to the local level. So a local district attorney would have to actually be the one to enforce that law. You could look at the places that provide the most abortions in Wisconsin right now, being Madison and Milwaukee. Knowing the political makeup of those counties and those areas, you might not have DAs enforcing that. It's hard to say. That could end up in court. I think, you know, like everything here in Wisconsin that people disagree about, it's likely that this would end up in court one way or another. But that's the long and short of it. It happens right away, and but it's up to locals to actually enforce it.
Well, let's look at what some of the state reaction has been so far. We know that at least 24 attorneys general have filed a brief in support of the Department of Justice, which has moved to temporarily block that Texas law. Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call signed onto that yesterday. What have we heard from his office?
Sure. You know, that was kind of the biggest policy step from them on this. You know, I did ask the DOJ about enforcement of the ban, and you know, as I said earlier, it is up to the local level. And he said, in addition to joining that lawsuit, he said that this is something the state legislature should act on. There has been legislation introduced to overturn that ban many times, hasn't gotten traction, obviously under the Republican legislature. But he, like others who aren't necessarily in a position to make the law, is saying the legislature should do that.
I want to go to one of our callers right now, Jesse. We have Cindy in Superior. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. I was just wondering why there wasn't a vote casted in Texas before this law was passed.
And do you mean in the state legislature, Cindy, or, you know, at the, I guess, the regular voter level?
Voter level.
Got it. Okay. Thank you, Cindy. So, Jesse, you don't cover Texas. You're based here in Wisconsin. But what have we heard about the political fight that went down in Texas?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know offhand what Texas's laws are in terms of, you know, what voters can have a say in and what that actually accomplishes. But, you know, say, for instance, here in Wisconsin, you could amend the Constitution with a vote, but you can't pass a law with a vote. So there are a lot of states, there are some states that do have binding referendums. You can put an issue to voters and say, you know, we as a legislature want to know what you think, and, you know, the law will happen based on the vote. States like Wisconsin, you can put an issue like that on the ballot, but it's non-binding. It basically serves for informational purposes. I don't know what the case is in Texas, but it's pretty rare for anything that, you know, it's pretty rare for something like that to go to a vote among citizens and not in the legislature.
Cindy, thank you for that call. And Jesse, thanks for localizing it, because it's one of those things that some people, you don't know how some of these laws are made. We are looking at Wisconsin's abortion laws and what might happen if the U.S. Supreme Court overturns Roe versus Wade. Jesse O'Poyan is with us. She's the State Capitol Bureau Chief with the Capitol Times. Now, you can join the conversation right now at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about what we might see here in Wisconsin? What are your opinions on Roe v. Wade? Do you want it to be maintained, or would you like it to be struck down? Call in now, 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. And we'll pick up this conversation in just a moment right here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. We're talking about the future of abortion here in Wisconsin. Abortion is technically illegal in this state. There is a law that was put in place in the mid-19th century, but Roe versus Wade superseded that ban for roughly the last 50 years. Now, advocates on both sides of the debate say the U.S. Supreme Court could be on the verge of overturning that ruling, so we're taking a look at what might happen here in Wisconsin in the event that that were to happen. Jesse Opoyan is the State Capitol Bureau Chief with the Capitol Times. She is with us, and you can join us at 800-642-1234. What has been your reaction to the new abortion law in Texas that has a lot of people both upset and on the other side of the abortion debate excited? You want to see it struck down, or perhaps you want to see it strengthened at the federal level. Call in now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. So, Jesse, we were just talking about Attorney General Josh Call signing on to this amicus brief that is basically saying, hey, Wisconsin does not support what we're seeing in Texas and other states. We support the Department of Justice's move here. What have we heard from other state lawmakers?
This falls pretty predictably along party lines. It wasn't always the case that abortion was easily predicted by party, but people's opinions generally seem to, at least in the legislature, fall by their party. So on the one hand, we've got Democrats and particularly, you know, some of the ones who have been more vocal about this over the years, who are saying it's important to pass that law that I mentioned earlier, which would get rid of the state's ban so that, should Roe versus Wade be overturned, it wouldn't even be a question. Given the makeup of the legislature, that's not going to happen. On the other hand, we've heard that Republican lawmakers, a few in particular, are working on a similar bill to the Texas bill. And former Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish, who's running for governor as a Republican, has signaled that if she were elected, that's something that she would want to sign into law.
Well, let's actually take a listen to something that, gubernatorial hopeful Rebecca Clayfish, she launched her campaign last week, and she was interviewed by conservative radio host Mark Belling on WISN in Milwaukee. And let's hear what she had to say.
I will sign a heartbeat bill. I have not seen the language of Donna Roser's bill, but I know it is in drafting right now. I have a long history of being pro-life, and I will fight for every human being with a heartbeat, Mark. Every human life.
So she mentioned Donna Roser there, and that's a state representative, a Republican from Marshfield, and she is currently working on an anti-abortion bill. First, let's talk about Clayfish. Where does she typically fall on this issue, and how did she respond to it when she was lieutenant governor?
Yeah, Rebecca Clayfish has always been among the more vocal anti-abortion advocates. So no surprise that this legislation is something that she's interested in. There's not necessarily much that the lieutenant governor can do on that issue, but she was definitely vocal in her support in speeches that she gave, or she weighed in on policy that was being considered.
And you were just talking about some bills that could be in the works. Clayfish obviously mentioned Donna Roser. What do we know about sort of the ongoing introduction of some of these bills and how they typically fare in our legislature?
We as a state, certainly over the last decade or so, have actually passed a lot of legislation regulating or restricting abortion. That happened pretty smoothly under Governor Scott Walker's tenure, because Republicans controlled both chambers of the legislature, and there was a Republican in the governor's office. Given our knowledge of how most other things have gone in state government with Republicans in the legislature and a Democrat in the governor's office now, certainly wouldn't think that this would be any different from any other issue that has resulted in gridlock. Plus, we know where Governor Evers stands on this. He would not be signing anything like that. But in the past, there are some laws that haven't ever made it. There's been an ongoing effort for years to try to restrict the use of fetal tissue in research, and that tends to get blocked every time it's introduced. On the other hand, a few years ago, Wisconsin did pass into law a ban on abortions after 20 weeks, which is in that period where it's not a direct challenge to Roe versus Wade the way that Mississippi's law at 15 weeks or Texas's at 6 would be.
We are talking to Jesse Opoyan right now, State Capitol Bureau Chief with the Capitol Times, and we are talking about a law that we have in Wisconsin that basically bans abortion. It has not been enforced in about 5 decades, but now there's been some renewed interest in learning more about it because of these laws that we've seen put in place in Mississippi and Texas. I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Scott in Madison. Hi, Scott.
Afternoon. My question is, how are child safety restraints in automobiles going to be worked into this legislation? It would seem to me that now they're set by weight of child, and since we're talking heartbeat law, that child has the right to be restrained properly, as in the back seat.
Scott, thank you for your call and for listening to us today. Now, Jesse, one thing I do want to talk about is you mentioned just a moment ago, Governor Evers, that it is extremely unlikely that he would ever support something like this. And in fact, he has vetoed abortion legislation in the past. And he tweeted, quote, you know, after the Supreme Court left Texas's law in place, "I will always trust women to make decisions about their bodies and their health care." You know, how is the governor's office tackling this right now?
I think that's pretty much what we've seen from them. You know, he's made his position clear. As you mentioned, he's vetoed bills before. He has, you know, campaigned on reproductive health rights, access to abortion, and you know, has followed through with what we all expected from that. So is he necessarily going to be out there campaigning on this? I think a little too early to tell, but you know, it does seem like this is going to be an issue that's going to be forced to the foreground, and given one of his potential opponents is already talking about it, we may see him become more active on it too.
Now, you have followed politics for a very long time, Jesse, and it feels like this cycles in a lot, and I don't mean to sound cynical, but we are heading into a midterm, and as you just mentioned, we don't know right now how Governor Evers, I mean, if he decides to run again, could make this part of his platform, but we already know that Clayfish is already talking about it. If you have a crystal ball, I suppose, how big of an issue do you think that this ultimately could be as we head into 2022?
I think it could be a lot bigger than the issue has played in previous elections. I think depending on the climate of any political cycle, this is an issue that sometimes politicians don't want to talk about at all. Obviously, it makes people uncomfortable in a lot of situations, and it's something that I think, you know, politicians have traditionally tried to stay away from when they're trying to hit that kind of middle of the road voter. On the other hand, this is an issue that really rallies bases on both sides of the issue. And we haven't been in a situation, as we've said several times throughout this conversation, we as a country haven't been in a situation like this before where the potential to overturn Roe is seemingly imminent. And so it will be something that motivates voters on both sides of the aisle. And I think, you know, as a result of that, we probably will see candidates talking about it more when they have tended to downplay it in a lot of previous elections.
Now, we've been mostly talking about politics, but there are, of course, advocates on the pro-choice side and the pro-life side. What have we heard in Wisconsin from people who are passionate about this issue?
Yeah, you know, from the pro-life side, the anti-abortion side, they're excited. They see potential. They also recognize the political reality that there's a Democrat in the governor's office who's not likely to advance a lot of the goals and legislation that they may be supporting. In my conversations with them, it's been talking a lot about kind of working within the framework that they have. Maybe even trying to find compromise bills if those exist, mm-hmm. Something that, you know, could get people on board and sort of advance things further. But it's also going to be just a lot of, you know, talking, education, campaigning, you know, trying to connect with voters and get the message out, you know, without necessarily being able to pass laws. You know, on the flip side of that, pro-choice or you know, pro-abortion right advocates also face the reality that while the governor might sign their legislation, it's not going to pass the legislature. So they're similarly sort of locked in place, working within that framework. But, you know, talking about the laws that they or the laws that they've tried to introduce, talking about that ban and reminding folks, I think, you know, on both sides, reminding folks that there's a lot at stake, depending on who's in which elected office and which way the Supreme Court goes and, you know, how all the dominoes fall into place.
Now, Jesse, we're still in what feels like an old story, but certainly in the earliest parts of the chapter of this one. What will you be watching for over, you know, the next few weeks or months as it as things start unfolding about Roe v. Wade, certainly federally, nationally, and here in Wisconsin?
Well, I'll definitely be curious to see if we see any other bills on either side of the issue. I think, you know, we'll see a pretty heated fight over that 6-week bill, even if its political fate is currently baked in. Also kind of keeping an eye on, there's a lawsuit actually currently going on related to Wisconsin's abortion regulations. Planned Parenthood is suing to allow advanced practice nurses, so that would be like a nurse practitioner or a nurse midwife, to administer the abortion medication for women who get a medication abortion, and to allow them, women, to take that at home via telephone or video rather than having to come into the office. So that case is still going on. It has nothing to do, no bearing with what the Supreme Court has decided on Texas or what it could decide on Mississippi, but kind of playing out in tandem to see whether the court says, you know, Wisconsin can keep this law in place, or whether it expands abortion access in Wisconsin. And it's been a mixed bag on that in the courts in past years.
Well, Jesse, we'll have to leave it there for right now, but thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jesse Opoyan is the State Capitol Bureau Chief with the Capitol Times. We talked with her about Wisconsin's abortion laws and how the practice here could potentially change if the U.S. Supreme Court were to overturn Roe versus Wade. Right now, we are following laws out of Texas and Mississippi that are challenging Roe versus Wade. Now, coming up after the news, we talked to the host of a personal finance podcast about everything you need to know about starting a college savings plan and paying off your student loan debt. And we want to hear from you. You can call in at 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Rob Ferret. Thanks for joining us. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on the morning show, MTV reached its 40th anniversary this year. They look back in television history to learn how early MTV gave audiences an alternative education in gender, sexuality, and race. That's tomorrow morning after 8 on the Ideas Network. Now, September is National College Savings Month, but between normal day-to-day bills and expenses and saving for a home or retirement, it can be really hard to figure out where to start. Our next guest has some advice for getting that college savings plan going and ways to tackle student loan debt. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What has been your experience saving for college? Are you staring down a whole lot of student loan debt? debt? And if so, what questions do you have about either saving on the front end or paying it off fast at the back end? Call in right now, 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. George Camel is a personal finance expert and host of the Fine Print and Entree Leadership podcasts. He's also a frequent co-host of The Ramsey Show with Dave Ramsey. George, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
So to prepare for this interview, I went back to think about how much my college education cost. And I looked at the current cost of the tuition today, and it has gone up basically double. And I went to a private school, so that's part of the problem. But the cost of college has gone up so much. Can you talk about the strain that puts on families?
Oh, absolutely. It's funny you say that. Since 1994, education costs have risen 436%. I mean, that is unfathomable. It's more than food, housing, healthcare, all these things. It has trumped them all. And there's a lot of villains, and we could do a lot of finger pointing. But really, what I like to look at is the individual American, the people who are actually saddled with this debt. 45 million Americans, $1.6 trillion in debt, and they're just drowning as they start their adult lives, as they try to have kids and buy houses and live, you know, this American dream, and they can't because their student loan payments are holding them back.
And this can be hundreds of dollars a month. Like, this is what feels like maybe a nice apartment or maybe a nice car payment every month, but it's just going towards their student loan debt. You know, as someone who does personal finance, like, what kinds of questions have you gotten from people, since right now we'll just look at student loans, when it comes to them?
Well, one of the biggest questions is, how do I get rid of this thing? Obviously, right? No one wants their debt. And, you know, you've heard the term good debt when it comes to college. And that is some of the most brilliant marketing. If I needed to sell someone on debt, I would tell them it's good debt because it's going to prepare you for your career and all these stats about how much more money you're going to make over the course of your lifetime. And what they don't tell you is that your dream comes with a price tag of $180,000, and you're going to be paying it off for 20 years, and you're not going to be able to do all the things you wanted to do because of your payments. And so there's a lot of questions around what your options are as a borrower and what I can do, and should I be applying for student loan forgiveness? And the numbers on that have been abysmal. I mean, even the most recent development of the student loan forgiveness program, we're seeing 2% of Americans actually get through that apply.
Yeah, and I've heard that people that thought that it would be either easy or that they were a shoo-in ended up not even qualifying. And I think that that's a really interesting part of the conversation, that there are programs, but you really have to jump through a lot of hoops to even qualify or to find out that you don't. You know, if we want to take a big structural look really quickly, do you think that there's anything that could be done to mitigate our student loan issue?
Well, we're seeing a lot of, you know, things in the news and politics and what's President Biden going to do to forgive student loan debt. And when you look at that stuff, it just makes you go, man, people need a plan for themselves. Mm-hmm. We can't rely on Congress to push some legislation through. That would be great. And it's something that absolutely is worth fighting for. And I just talked to Seth Frotman, who's the executive director of the Student Borrower Protection Center, and he's working on this. I mean, he is fighting tooth and nail to get legislation done to protect people who really are in a terrible financial position because of the student loan debt. And there are some scams out there, too. Mm-hmm. But the biggest thing I want people to realize is that they have control. It doesn't have to be this way, and they don't have to wait on the next president to solve their issues. And we help people with these kinds of issues every day, regardless of what type of debt it is. But obviously, student loan debt is the elephant in the room that we have to start talking about and start getting rid of.
We're talking to George Camel right now, personal finance expert and host of the Fine Print and Entree Leadership podcasts. He's also a frequent co-host of The Ramsey Show with Dave Ramsey. And we are talking about both paying off student loans, but also saving for college in advance. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234 with your questions. Well, if we're going to look at individuals, you know, it's the future seems far off. Like, if you have a baby and you have 18 years to save for, you know, a chunk of their education expense, does it take some, I guess, some retooling mentally to think about the sort of long-term implications when we have so many short-term bills in the immediate.
Yeah, absolutely. And the earlier you start these conversations, the better off things are going to be. And what I'm finding as I've talked to high schoolers, you know, we had this a podcast series called Borrowed Future. It's an 8-episode podcast series that you can check out wherever you listen to podcasts. And it was all about the student loan crisis. And I sat down with high schoolers and I would ask them basic questions. Where do you want to go to school? How much is that going to be? How are you going to pay for that? And I didn't know this, but it ended up feeling like an interrogation. And they were frightened out of their mind. And I went, oh my gosh, I'm the first person to ask them these questions. They're not having these conversations at home. So if you're a parent out there, start these conversations early. Don't wait until they're 17 and applying for colleges to figure out how we're going to pay for college, where we're going to go, how much it's going to cost. And be realistic and be honest with the expectations of who's going to pay for what and where we're at financially and what does financial aid look like. And at all costs, I want people to avoid student loan debt. I don't want to add to the $1.6 trillion number. My dream is for people to, more and more stories that we are hearing on the Ramsey Show, people going, wow, I didn't know it was possible, but I went to school debt-free because I did what you guys teach, and I made a plan, and my parents saved, or I applied for scholarships and grants, or I went to an affordable school instead of a name brand famous college, and it works. And they can start their adult lives with no payments.
So for parents who might want to start saving now, what resources are available to them?
One of my favorite resources for saving for college is called an ESA, and it stands for Education Savings Account, or you may have heard of this as an Education IRA. And it works very similarly to a Roth IRA, except mm-hmm. that it's just for education expenses. So you can invest up to $2,000 of after-tax dollars per year per child. And the best part is it grows tax-free, which means whatever money's in there, you can pull out with no tax implications there. So if you put away $2,000 a year, starting when your child is born, right? That's the ideal scenario. And by the time they turn 18, you would have put in $36,000, right? 2,000 times 18. And depending on the rate of growth and the rate of return, you know, 10 to 12% is what you'd be looking at on average. And that $36,000 that you put in would turn into $126,000 by the time that your child starts school. So that's an incredible savings tool that people aren't taking advantage of as they should. And $2,000 a year is not that much if you're in a good financial position. And so we teach people to live a debt-free lifestyle and have an emergency fund, you know, in case there's a pandemic or in case your tires blow out or you need a new HVAC. And so having a good financial foundation as a parent is what you need to focus on first, because there's a 100% chance that you will retire as a parent. But there's a 50-50 chance that your kid will go to college and graduate. So I want you to kind of put your mask on first as the parent and get yourself in a good financial position. But be honest with your child about where you're at financially and see, hey, can they work part-time while they're in high school, while they're in college? Can they apply for scholarships and grants like it's a part-time job? You know, can we choose an affordable college in our community where there may be a program that they can go to college free or very affordably instead of dropping 80 grand to go to the college in the state next door because of the football team and the landscaping and the cafeteria? These are the reasons children are choosing these schools, not because of the education, but because of the experience.
And that feels like a whole other can of worms in conversation sometimes. We are talking to George Camel right now. He's the host of the Personal Finance Podcast, The Fine Print, and the Entree Leadership Podcast about business and leadership. And he's with us today to talk about strategies for saving for college during National College Savings Month. And you can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. Are you a parent who's currently saving for your kids' education? Maybe you're a family member that's contributing to, you know, a fund for a relative. You know, how have you tackled that? What challenges have you run into? Call in now at 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. And we'll continue this conversation and take your calls coming up next right here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Thanks for being with us. Right now, we continue our discussion about saving for college. September is National College Savings Month. George Camel stays with us. He's a personal finance expert and host of The Fine Print and Entree Leadership Podcasts. And we want to hear your thoughts and your questions and share your experiences about saving for college or maybe even dealing with student loan debt. Call in now, 800-642-1234. Again, that number is 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Now, George, you were just talking about education savings accounts, and you likened them to a Roth IRA, which means that you put money in after you've already paid taxes, so you can take that money out, you know, when the time is right. Now, there are other accounts as well, like 529, that people may be more familiar with. Can you talk about that kind of account?
Absolutely. So the 529 plan can be a really great option for a lot of people, and it's always state dependent for those 529 plans. But what I love about them is that they're higher contribution rates. So we talked about that $2,000 limit for an ESA. Well, the 529, it's much, much higher. It varies by state, but generally you can contribute up to $300,000. And most of the time, there aren't any income limits or restrictions based on age. And this also grows tax-free. You can use it for K-12 tuition, vocational schools, textbooks, you name it, anything associated to education costs. So there are some restrictions if you want to transfer this to another child. So look into that for your state. But either way, this really comes down to one simple principle. If you invest nothing, you'll have nothing. And so I want parents to get on this as early as they can. And like I mentioned earlier, it means getting out of debt for yourself as a parent. And that means having an emergency fund before you start investing for your kid's college. We teach something here at Ramsey called the baby steps. And it doesn't happen until baby step five that we go, okay, it's time to start saving for college. Baby step five happens after we've gotten out of debt, we have an emergency fund, we're investing 15% of our household income into retirement for ourselves, and then we can talk about saving for college. And so a lot of people are trying to do 17 things at once, and they're wondering why they're not making progress, and it's a very stressful situation. So once you start doing these things in order, you're going to feel that progress and realize that there are options out there. And having that conversation with your child, it starts there. That is the number one thing parents need to be doing, is just talk about it. Talk about your kids' dreams and then figure out if that's going to be a reality or not. Can they go to, you know, NYU at $80,000 a year? How are we going to pay for that and not saddle them with, you know, $300,000+ in student loan debt?
You know, I want to go to one of our callers right now, George. We have Bill in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Hi, I'd like to, first of all, I think your guest has made some excellent points about ways to save for college and do it in an efficient and sensible way. But he also refers to student loan debt as the elephant in the room, as if it's some looming social problem that needs to be solved. Well, the fact is that investments in education by students is an excellent investment, at least as good as the investment that other investments that he's been talking about. And yet it's presented as it's some problem that the rest of us have to solve. Let the students solve it. The student's the one who's benefiting the most. Why should people who make a lot less than the average college student be underwriting this investment for the student? Leave it to the student to pay.
Bill, thank you for that call. And I think that's part of the larger structural conversation that a lot of, everyone from, parents to lawmakers are really grappling with right now, which is the responsibility, who it falls to and who ultimately will pay for it. Can we go back to, the structural issues facing students today that might not have been around 20, 30 years ago?
Yeah, absolutely. And Bill brings up a great point. And I'm not advocating for someone else to foot the bill for all of education for all students. I think there are a lot of state and community colleges that already have programs in place where you can go to these colleges debt-free without having to pay. And those are some great opportunities that need to be taken advantage of. But when it comes to student loan forgiveness, I don't know if Bill is talking about that. I don't think that student loan forgiveness is the answer. I think it's just a Band-Aid, and we need to get to the root of the problem, which is the student loan program that's federal right now. Because if we just pay off the $1.6 trillion, we're going to have another $1.6 trillion real soon because the program hasn't stopped. So they're still giving away money to these 18-year-olds who don't have not a clue what it's like to take on $200,000 of debt. And we're just handing it over to them, and parents are co-signing, so they're on the hook too now, or grandparents. And so what I want to see is just this conversation where we go, what makes sense? How much can we actually afford to pay without going into massive amounts of debt and dealing with that for the rest of our adult life? Because what we're seeing, this is a shocking stat. 12 years after borrowing, the average borrower has only paid off 34% of their student loans. 12 years later, they're only a third of the way through. And so we're seeing people taking 20 years to pay off their debt, which means they're in their mid-40s, and they're still making these payments, and they've paid thousands upon thousands in interest. And so what I want to see is people advocating for themselves and people setting themselves up for success.
I want to go back to one of our callers right now. We have Mike from Brookfield. Hi, Mike.
Hi. This is kind of near and dear to my heart because I was a student that took out student loans. I was a veteran, and I went through grad school as well. And, you know, when you come out and you don't get that great paying job, or you don't get a job that can pay for not only your living expenses and your student loans, and then you find that the student loans move from one bank to another, and the guarantee on those interest rates, you know, you thought as a student was going to stay there, and then you find the interest rates went up and banks started to sell your loans to other banks. That guarantee kind of went away, and I just wish that we could go back to a state where those loans had an interest rate. That interest rate is fixed until they're completely paid off, and it just stays that way so that they don't get saddled with this debt, that the guarantee from the federal government was there in place.
Mike, thank you so much for that call. And Mike brings up some really interesting kind of under the water issues that we see with these loans, which is that they can be bought and sold basically behind the scenes. And you might get a letter saying, hey, your interest rate is this now. You know, how does that challenge people who are really trying to aggressively pay off their student loans?
Yeah, that's a huge issue. And there's a variable interest rate here that Mike's talking about where, hey, it went from 3% and now it got sold to a bank and now they're charging me 6%. And what it does, it deflates your progress because you're trying to make these minimum payments and it's not going anywhere when you realize that the principal is still the same, or in some cases, it's gone up. And we feature a guy in our new documentary, Borrowed Future, coming out October 14th, and he went $1 million in debt. He did his undergrad completely debt-free, and he ended up being an orthodontist and went $1 million in debt. And he was paying tens of thousands of dollars, and it wasn't going anywhere. And in fact, it was growing because of the interest rate on a number that massive. And so that is why we advocate for an intensity when it comes to paying off debt. We can't do this willy-nilly. We can't do this in 20 years. I want you to do this in 2 years, in 3 years, in 4 years in some cases. And a lot of people can do this following our plan. And the reason I say that, it's not a theory. I meet them every day in the lobby. We just had a debt-free scream on the air where a couple paid off their student loan debt, and they did it in 2 years. And it didn't take them 20 years to pay off. And the way you do that is following our proven plan. We have a method called the debt snowball where you're listing these out from smallest to largest, and you're paying the minimum payments on everything except for the smallest debt. And here's the hard part, the mathematics on it. You go, well, wouldn't it make sense to pay off the highest interest rate first? Yeah, but we're not doing math here. This is about behavior change. This is about feeling the progress. So once you list them out from smallest to largest, we attack the smallest one with everything we've got. We're taking on side jobs. We're scaling back. We're not eating out. We're going to do this for a short period of time in order to feel the progress and pay down this debt. When you do that, you free up a payment. So we can apply that to the next loan and the next loan. And that's why we call it the snowball. It gains snow as it rolls down the hill. And that is the method I would recommend to anyone who doesn't want to be paying on their student loans for the next 20 years.
George, we heard from Don in Appleton who couldn't stay with us, but he called in to talk about his kids. They're going to college. His son went through debt-free, and his daughter is really interested in going to a school that is more expensive, and the money set aside, as he puts it, will be gone within 2 years. We only have about a minute left. What advice do you have for parents? We kind of touched on this, to tackle that conversation with their kids about maybe not going to the name brand school or something like that, but to kind of go to school within their means.
Yeah. So if you know this is on the horizon and there's not enough money in the bank to cover this, what I would tell you is that you need to have a plan. This needs to be a partnership with your kid where you go, hey, you're going to take on a job. And actually what we found is that people who take on jobs while they're in college actually have a higher GPA. And it makes sense. You're more disciplined. You've got to keep track of everything going on in your life, and you're not hanging out with friends on the weekends and partying. You're focused on getting a degree, which is why you're there, let me remind you, and you're working this job, which is bringing in some money, and applying for aid not only before you go to college, but every single semester. be applying for grants, scholarships. I want you to be on a first-name basis with your financial aid counselors and guidance counselors, and don't fall for aid that is secretly student loans. They go, hey, congrats, we can give you loans. So have a plan, try to cash flow this as much as you can, and avoid debt like the plague.
George, thank you so much for joining us. I wish we had some more time.
Well, I had a blast. Thank you so much for having me.
That was George Kamel. He's a personal finance expert and the host of the Fine Print and Entree Leadership podcast. He's also a frequent co-host of the Ramsey Show with Dave Ramsey, and he was here to talk about saving for college and paying off student loan debt. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. The National Toy Hall of Fame in New York announced the 12 finalists for 2021 induction. The nominees include American Girl Dolls, which many of us in Wisconsin are familiar with, and the board game Risk. Cabbage Patch Kids dolls are also nominated, as is Sand. Joining us now to talk about her favorite toy from her childhood, or maybe even adulthood, we have Central Time producer Colleen Leahy.
Hi, JC.
So what is your favorite?
I mean, I don't know if it's my favorite, but I do have a bit of a flash. I mean, I have a memory of it, and it is the cardboard box, or really it's one specific cardboard box, which is the cardboard box my mom's treadmill came in when she bought a treadmill circa like 1998. Yeah.
So I take it that you had some adventures in that box with your imagination.
Yes, absolutely. My sister and I played with it for weeks. But honestly, looking back, I'm like, what were we doing? Like, what were we doing in there? I have no idea. Like, the only thing I can remember is that it got kind of battered up after a while. And so we would just go inside of it and like crawl so that it would be like a giant hamster wheel going across our yard. We love it.
Well, Colleen, we'll have to leave it there. The cardboard box, a favorite toy. This is Central Time.